This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Thanks so much for joining the TriDot Podcast today. Really excited for our conversation. We'll get a glimpse of the inner workings of the race experience from a seasoned race director. We are very familiar with navigating race week as athletes, Sherpas, and spectators, but what is race week like for the race director? Today, we'll hear all about it as we're joined by Greg Pennington. Greg has over two decades of experience as a race director and currently serves as the RD for Ironman Texas, Ironman 70.3 Texas, Oilman, Ironman Waco, and 70.3 Waco. When he isn't race directing, he works a variety of Ironman events every year, coordinating the bike and run courses. And on top of all that, he is a five-time Ironman finisher himself. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here with you guys. Haven't done this before with you guys, but happy to get with it. We do some of that stuff through Ironman with some of the promotional stuff. Getting ready for the races.
Longtime race director, first time podcaster. So, yes. Yep, we're good with that. Also joining Greg and I today is TriDot coach John Mayfield. John is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who leads TriDot's athlete services, ambassador, and coaching programs. He has coached hundreds of athletes ranging from first-timers to Kona qualifiers and professional triathletes. John has been using TriDot since 2010 and coaching with TriDot since 2012. John, are you you excited to talk to Greg today? Now, John, I'm like interrupting you already. You've actually raced several of Greg's races. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I was thinking back earlier that I've raced every distance of triathlon under Greg's tutelage. So everything sprint, Olympic, half, full. I've done them all with Greg Pennington as race director, and a lot of those go back to my early days in racing the local sprints and Olympics, and then when I distanced up to the halves and fulls, Greg was there for all of them. So I can personally vouch he does a fantastic job, puts on a great race. Excited to get to have him on the podcast.
You survived to tell about it.
I've survived them all so far.
Which means you did your job correctly as race director.
Yes.
My one Greg Pennington race was 70.3 Waco, the inaugural one. That's the one race I've done that you were race director. So thanks for a good experience. It went as well as it could have, I think.
Yes.
And now we're all here. So, well, I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question. We'll settle in for our main set conversation. And then we'll wind things down with our cool down. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Whether it's a TV show, sports coverage, a live stage event, or a race production, the host, announcer, or MC of an event often sets the tone for the crowd and ensures the event runs smoothly. So Greg, John, for our warm-up question today, if you could select any famous entertainer, sportscaster, newscaster, or celebrity to MC your next race event, who would you pick and why? And Greg, you're the veteran here. You have the expertise. If you could choose anyone, anywhere, to MC your next race event as race director, who would you want on the microphone?
All right. That's an easy pick for me. I'm a long time parrot head, and I would be picking Jimmy Buffett to be my MC.
Wow.
Have a little music action to it. He's got a ton of stories, anecdotal stories about life, everything. And I'm a parrot head. I'd go with Jimmy.
Do you think at all, do you think he'd be too low key to pump up the crowd at an Ironman, or do you think he'd get into the action and really get everybody going?
Oh, if you've been to some of his concerts, he gets after it.
Okay.
Yes.
So a little side note here, Greg actually hosts a fantastic half distance triathlon at a Margaritaville resort, which is a premier race at a premier location. It is fantastic. The newly, couple years ago, they remodeled an existing facility into Margaritaville. It is a super cool place. It is a super cool race, and it is a super cool place to have a race. So Put that one on your list. Oilman Triathlon every fall, put on by Greg Pennington. So great. I guess that's Greg combining his love of triathlon and Jimmy Buffett.
I wish I
could
take credit for them, you know, putting that on their
because the race predates Margaritaville.
Oh yeah,
so it's
getting
dumb
it 18 years.
It turned into
They got the license for it, and so all week long you're in the restaurants and the hotel, and they're piping Jimmy Buffett music in. And I feel like I was in heaven.
Yeah, it's a super cool event.
I'm happy for you, Greg. I'm glad you have that. I really, really am. And now I need to come race this event one of these days.
So, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You do. Go upstairs in your room, look out over everything, and then walk downstairs, and you're right in the middle of the action.
Yep.
John Mayfield, coming to you for this question. If you could choose any MC for your next race event, who would you want on the microphone?
So full disclosure, I didn't even know the name, and he's one of those guys that most people probably don't know the name, but they know him. So in addition to being a fan of triathlon, I'm also a fan of boxing, especially was probably 10, 20 years ago when boxing was still somewhat in its prime. But Michael Buffer is the man who starts all the marquee fights, and we all know his tagline, "Let's get ready to rumble." I think that would be super cool to get that going before Iron Man, get everybody there, and it's only appropriate as we all head into these open water swims that it's a lot like a boxing match or a wrestling fight. But so we're definitely getting ready to rumble. I think he would be a fantastic MC to kick off a race.
Okay, so for me on this, I'm going with. I thought of a lot of different things, but there's a TV show that I watch that I enjoy. American Ninja Warrior. You guys ever watch that show on
yes.
television?
Yeah.
Fun show. I used to follow it a little bit closer than I do now, but the hosts of that show, Matt Eisman and Akbar Gbashabiamila, they are fantastic on the microphone for that show. Because here's the thing, essentially. Every single run on American Ninja Warrior, and for folks who haven't seen that show, it's an obstacle course competition. You have very fit people taking on a very difficult obstacle course that it takes a lot of strength to get through. And these guys are commentating for their entire run. So the course is always the same. The athletes are always doing the same thing. And in one episode, in one season, you know, you'll watch 50, 60, 70 different runs on this same obstacle course. And these guys, the result is always the same. They either make it through the obstacle course or they fall into the water. And those are the two variations that could possibly happen when an athlete takes on this course. And somehow, Matt and Akbar make it so scintillating and so interesting and so fascinating to watch. Like they get jazzed up and fired up by every single run as if they've never seen an American Ninja Warrior run before. And that's the kind of energy I want on the microphone late at night when athletes are coming, you know, home to the finish line, acting like that athlete is the biggest deal in the world, even though you've just called 100 other athletes right before it. So I think they would be fantastic at Ironman or at any triathlon event because, frankly, I've seen them do it on American Ninja Warrior time and time again. So that's my pick. We're going to throw this question out like we always do to our Facebook community. So if you are not a part of the I Am Triathlete Facebook group, we have thousands of athletes there just talking swim, bike, and run every single week. Go to the group today and find this question. Who would you want on the microphone as the MC of your next race event? And let's see what you have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Whether it's a local sprint or a full-blown Ironman, putting on a multi-sport event takes leadership, teamwork, and lots of water, bananas, and energy gels. Logistical tasks like designing a good course, getting plans approved by the city, and recruiting volunteers doesn't happen by accident. And for any successful event, all of the moving parts come together under the watchful eye of the race director making it all happen on the athlete's behalf. So, Greg, there is a lot that goes into producing a quality race. You know, we have some great talking points today just about, you know, the inner workings of race production. But before we get to that, you know, I want to hear how you became a race director in the first place. I understand you got your start at the local level kind of in an effort to raise money for a nonprofit. You know, take us back, you know, in time and tell us about all that.
All right. I moved back to Houston in about 1990. I'd done some triathlons up in the Dallas, Oklahoma area for a couple of years and came down and started competing. And then I started working in the nonprofit world and then started working for a nonprofit. Had to raise 50% of my package or my salary through fundraising.
Okay.
And trying to do that, writing letters to friends and all of that kind of stuff.
The interesting way to do life for a little while.
Yes. Yeah. It can get old and you can get tired of asking.
Yeah.
And so I was able to talk to Dave Rainey, who is kind of like the king of triathlons in the Houston area, the godfather, you might say, been around a long, long time, helped write some stuff for USAT back in the day. And then back when it was called TriFed, I think, back then. And then started talking to him and he said, hey, I got a place you can race direct. I'll help you. And that can be a fundraiser for you. So there had been a Tejas triathlon for a year or two run by a community center leader down there. And he left and moved. And so it kind of died for about a year or two. So I kind of resurrected that. I was the young Jedi to Dave Rainey and learned the business from him. And that's kind of how I got started.
Well, very cool. So fast forward to now, and you know, you are the RD for some of the biggest races in the United States. You know, from where you sit now, you know, when you think back to those early years doing those local races that you produced, you know, what are some of the memories that stand out for you?
That I barely made it. Some of those races, nip and tuck at times and trying to get stuff done. I remember having a volunteer putting out cones on the bike course, getting a call from the police coordinator saying there's not enough cones out here, and having to jet out in my Suburban and watching the lead guy and staying ahead of him, putting extra cones down on the road. I think I burned up my transmission on that race doing that. That was
okay.
Definitely a early memory there. I think, you know, it was grassroots back then, you know, more so now. All the race directors helped each other out. They'd come out, Andy Stewart, Kevin and Jana Landry, Dave Rainey, they'd come out and help at your races.
Very cool.
And we're a big support back then when you're trying to do it. I think setting up transition areas with orange fencing that usually it's construction zones, times not having enough of that and having people lay down their bikes in the grass. And
just to help form that barricade.
Yes. Yes. That was definitely some of the, you know, the early years for that. I think the camaraderie of those race directors was really big in making it all work. Low budget, no frills. If you had some signs out, you really needed to know the courses back then. You're expected okay. to know them now, but back then you really did. Otherwise you could get lost.
Oh, I believe it.
With that, because there'd be just a little stick, you know, arrow or something in the ground and that was it. I remember back then, no GPS to speak of, at least I couldn't afford it, however expensive it was. So we used the golf laser range finders.
To measure courses?
To measure, from buoy to buoy until you got your distance.
Wow.
for yardage. And then basically you just using an odometer on your bicycle.
To map out the bike course?
The bike course and the run course.
Okay.
Yeah. And the bike course, you use your car odometer for that one. And so, you were within a mile. You're good enough on that puppy.
These days, athletes want it so precise. Like, oh, it was 15.5. You said 15. Like,
yes. Yeah. I love the swim remarks about that. Because when you watch the swim and you see all the snakes around there.
Everybody's zigzagging.
Oh, yeah. They're going at least a quarter mile long.
And they tell you how wrong your course was.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, give me 10 GPSs. They're anywhere close to the same.
Yeah.
We can't even do that when we're measuring with GPSs as staff with our events. None of them are the same.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're just kind of getting a mean or median on that thing and going for it. We don't do like the runs where you have to certify those courses and have to have the guys on the bicycles with the Jones counters getting it, you know, nailed down. They say that's the only way that you can really
truly know.
Yeah, because of the vectors, you know, and the tangents that you're having to do with the
makes sense.
Yeah, over 26 miles, it makes a big difference on what you do. And I mean, we talk about that even in execution, is hitting those tangents and shortening the course, making the course as short as possible. But yeah, so even when it comes to certifying and knowing what distance your course is, that's part of it. So yeah, it's different whether you hit those tangents or take them wide, or, and depending on the race, you know, it could be crowded and you may not have the opportunity to take that most inside track.
To see how far it's come and hear from, as a race director, you've seen how far the sport's come. You know, what were some of the differences of races back then versus the races you put on today?
again, just more low budget, you know, low frills with that. You know, if you got water, that was great. Mm-hmm. You know, there, you weren't getting your choice of liquids and all of that out there as water. And, you know, you hope there was a volunteer, you know, at the cooler putting some stuff out
None
there.
Of the buffets that we're accustomed to these days.
Correct. Yes. I think that was a big thing. I think, you know, all the guys back then wearing Speedos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was.
I'm not brave enough.
Yeah. That's what we all wore back then. I look at the picture. It's like, golly, I look pretty good in that Speedo then. Mm-hmm. I'm not wearing it now.
So over the years, you know, you're doing a lot of local events in Houston. How did you get connected to Ironman to start producing races for Ironman?
That happened through a connection back when Keith Jordan, who was with Endorphin Sports, he started race directing up in the New Hampshire area with Timberman and Moose Man, I think were his. Then he moved to Texas, and then he started the Galveston Lone Star Triathlon mm-hmm. Festival, and then the Austin Tri. And then I got connected with him and was kind of working a little bit just kind of as a volunteer for about a year. And then he sold all those races to Ironman. And then I got connected to Ironman through that.
Okay.
And was hoping to be the race director for Galveston. And that didn't happen. But the consolation prize was, hey, do you want to be the volunteer director for that? And I said, okay, get my foot in the door
with
that way. And then at the same time, they were getting ready to start Ironman Texas. So I was the inaugural volunteer director for that race as well. And then the RD for those races moved back to Tampa in about 3 years. And he was looking to do that. And so I was kind of following him around to meetings and learning the Ironman system of how they do things, going to the agency meetings and all of that. So it was a pretty quick changeover to take over for that.
So how does it work being an RD? I think as an athlete, you show up to a race, you understand there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of things going on. You know, for folks that are race directors, like is this a full-time gig or is this something seasonal that when your race is coming up, you start working on it, but you have another job along the way? Like how does it work just professionally being a RD?
I think from a local standpoint, most RDs have other jobs to do. They may have a run store, a bike store, a teacher, and this is just something that's a hobby and that they take on. Unless you're going to try to race direct 10 events over the course of the year, it's hard to really make a living doing that.
And so for you, when you first started, it supplemented your income working for this
the nonprofit. Yeah. Correct. Okay. Yes. Yeah. For about 10 years. And then I started my own nonprofit and has raised money for that. And that was getting to be a struggle. And so when I was able to latch on to Ironman, then I was able to get a little bit more of a regular type salary to kind of make ends meet.
Yeah,
and then
sure.
still do some of my own stuff as well.
And you and I were actually talking before we started recording, when we were setting up the recording equipment here in the room, we were talking about how, like you just mentioned, okay, you've got the races you produce, which we mentioned in your intro, you produce Ironman Texas, Ironman Waco, and 70.3 Waco, as well as 70.3 Galveston for Ironman. And then from there, you'll pick, like you just said, a few events around the year. How do you decide when you're looking at the Ironman schedule, and there's so many 70.3s and there's the dozen or so full distance Ironman here in North America, how do you decide which races you want to go and kind of work at for the ones that you're involved in that aren't the ones you're a race director for?
Sure. I'm kind of like probably a lot of athletes out there is, especially if you're from Texas, you want to go someplace cooler for the most part.
Yeah.
You want to try something that's a little less flat to go to. So I usually head north, again, west, north, east to get out of the heat. I like to pick the picturesque places. So mm-hmm. I like Coeur d'Alene. I like Lake Placid. Back when they had Lake Stevens up near Seattle, was an amazing venue place. Boise, Idaho, Boulder. You know, the ones that are all at some of those top of the bucket list mm-hmm. places, those are all great ones to work. Maryland, you just name all those places and, hey, I want to work that and be around there and enjoy places I've never been to before. So it's not like it's a vacation, but I get to do some of the nightlife
stuff. It's like a workcation?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
And that's very much similar to we've talked about before when we go and we do all these trips. It's very much it's a lot of work when we're on those. But, man, all those places you mentioned, I love and I miss some of those spots. Like, I always enjoyed going to Boulder every year. I hate that race isn't happening anymore. But yeah, it was just a great opportunity to go and see a new place and experience it. And what I do as a coach is obviously different than what Greg does as a race director. But definitely that same sentiment of which races are we going to go to? Well, we're going to go to the ones that we want to go to. we're going to pick those first, and then we'll kind of filter down those that are maybe a little less desirable. But they're all great, and I always say they each have their own personality, they have their own culture. No two, even especially with Ironman, no two races are the same. They're the same distance, but you know, that's almost where the similarities end. They each have their own personality. So it's really cool to go and see all those and experience not only the race, but just the local culture and the local sites and all that is great. Great opportunity to go. And two are a little different. I always say, too, it's like the places I've gone to, I most likely would have never gone to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Why would you? Kind of a thing. But it's a gem of a little city. And there's 100 of those around. So it's just a great opportunity to kind of get off the beaten path, whether it's your job or whether it's your hobby.
You know, it takes a lot of people to put together a good race. So specifically, what is the role of the race director? What are your responsibilities?
I could talk about it in two different ways. One, I'm the local race director, and you're the race director, and you're the chief bottle washer, and you're doing all those other things that you have a lot of support people at Ironman doing. And so you typically have a group of about 5 to 10 people that are volunteers, that are good friends that you kind of coerce into helping you put together that race.
Yeah.
And so you're helping teach them and train them during that week and hoping that they're listening to you and following your instructions.
Okay.
For that to complete the event in terms of the production
level.
At the local level.
Okay.
Yes. On the Ironman side, you're more of a race conductor in a sense, especially on race week. Your preparation is the same for either one. There's a scale to it, of course, that ramps up dramatically for Ironman races, but it's still the same. It's swim, bike, run, and what's related to that, permits. You got to need a permit for a local race like you do for an Ironman race, all that stuff. It's just the number of athletes, the number of staff, and all that. So there's anywhere from 50 to 75 folks that fly in that either work full-time or contractors for Ironman, many of which are fellow race directors. So on your bike team, let's say you've got four staff people, three of those four are Ironman race directors are on there. So you can give them a map and turn them loose and you know,
it's
going to be dialed in.
Yeah.
And so there's a trust factor that's there. Again, they're doing it week to week, you know, race to race. Sometimes we call ourselves carnies because you're just loading up, going to the next race, unloading it, doing it again, packing up and leaving again. And so you just get it dialed in. And so, again, that trust factor is the same. You've got usually 3 to 4 staff on the swim, 3 to 4 on the bike, 3 or 4 the run. You've got registration coordinators, finish line coordinators, all your build out crews, your merchandise people, your truck folks with the supply areas that are getting all the shipments in the week before, food, all those different things that are coming in, awards, everything that's come in, UPS. We're very good friends with UPS.
I believe it.
FedEx,
I bet you are.
Coming in the week before. Orders, you know, forklifts, gaiters,
porta potties,
yes, dumpsters, ice, all those things, again, at a scale that's a lot different than on a local level.
Random question.
Okay.
Approximately how many porta potties are at an Ironman race event?
100 to 200, I would say. Yeah. You've got some, when you've got your point to point places, you probably get up to 250, 300 portos. So I'm just getting my stuff ready for the Waco Festival weekend, and we're at 250.
Wow.
So Greg, just walk us through just the process of putting on one of these races. I mean, we kind of gotten a glimpse from you of logistically all the things that go into it. We've gotten a glimpse of the team and the support staff you have under you to have it all come together and some of the equipment that it takes, the amount of porta potties even that it takes. just timeline-wise, you know, as you're working towards an event? I mean, how does it all play out?
Sure. I'll stick with the Ironman races just to keep it similar in a sense for that with you guys. Usually about 6 months out. Typically, you've got the date already set that Ironman has taken care of through the host venue agreement that they have with whatever city or group that you're working with. So you already know the date. So that part. So backing up 6 months, then I'll start having agency meetings with police, city folks, parks and rec, whoever's involved with some of those gatekeepers with the decision-making process.
Are they usually very open and excited for Ironman to come, or is that kind of like you know pulling teeth to get them amped up for it, or what's usually the reception there?
For the most
there?
Part, they're excited.
Okay, very cool
about it. You can occasionally you'll get some folks that you know have to get dragged into it because they're in charge of the police and they don't really want to be doing that kind of thing, but that's their job, so they'll be a part of it. So you have to work your magic as a race director and a facilitator
and get them excited
and a politician. Take them out to lunch.
Just tell them what that economic impact is going to be, and then they probably get a little more excited.
They do get a little bit excited. So that's how we get started, is starting those all agency meetings. And then from there you start placing some early orders. Again, some of the equipment you got to get, you know, dialed in way ahead of time so that those places like United Rentals has enough light towers. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we'll have 40 light towers in an event. And then 10 UTV, you know, carts, and then 10 forklifts and all those things that you have to get squared away. You got to get them done. Can't be waiting a month in advance and they say, we don't have them. And then I'm in trouble. Big time. So a lot of that's going on. Coursework. It depends on if you're just getting started a brand new event. That's definitely a lot of coursework, lots of driving, lots of measuring, lots of talking to people, having police officers go with you on drive-bys.
Did you do a lot of that yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. If it's your race, you're doing all that.
Okay.
Yourself. You're creating the race. You're creating the scope of it and the courses for that. So you're doing that. Now, if it's established event, hopefully you're just being able to push the redial button on that. Sometimes you get curveballs, especially with construction and things that come up that is like, oops, where you can't, you know, do that. And you have to do a workaround. And then if it's a loop course, out and back's always easy to do, but it's the loop courses that try to get it dialed into 13.1 or 26.2 or 56, you know, the 112 that, you know, make it pretty tough to get it dialed in exactly.
So if there's ever just a really random diversion, like halfway down a street and back, it's always...
That's it. We call it the mileage grab.
Okay.
The mileage grab. Yeah. A little out and back.
The mileage grab. So it even has a term, John. It has a name.
Yep. Yeah.
So you can think of what it is. This is a mileage grab I'm doing right now. This is right. Random out and back.
Yeah. Why the hell am I going, you know, a quarter mile up and a quarter mile back?
Yep.
That's why for that. There was one of those at Waco, I think maybe the second year where you went past where the suspension bridge thing, you know, 100 yards and then came back.
And turned around.
Yeah, turned around and came back, you know, and people
thought they were lost or something. Like, why am I doing this? Yeah.
Right.
Then,
yes.
Yeah. Then you look at your watch and you know why.
Yeah. That was it.
Interesting.
So yeah, that part of it. So your course development stuff, again, working with your local folks to get your venues, whether it's parking lots, where you're going to set transition, whether that's a park or something, you've got to get those venue agreements and get your certificates of insurance are always fun. The language that they want in those certificates of insurance usually goes back and forth.
I can imagine.
Legal department, you know, they want this phrase in there and otherwise they're not going to give you that venue. So there's lots of different features on that. Again, depends on if it's a full, if you're having to deal with a banquet, you know, or a welcome, you know, reception thing. And so you've got to find those places to work with. A big component that I haven't talked about yet is the volunteers. And a local race, there's definitely plenty of volunteers. And we've done a great job with our races of finding those volunteers and being able to keep them from year to year. And you're able to give donations to those volunteer groups and keep them coming back. Ironman's the same way. There's a volunteer director. And so I have three great volunteer directors that I work with in Galveston and Ironman, Texas and Waco. And you rely on those folks and work with them a lot to get to the number of volunteers you need, sometimes 1,000, sometimes 2,000 volunteers, with anywhere from 40 to 60 volunteer groups that that you're working with to take care of the athletes. And so I know a lot of the athletes recognize that over the course of their time as well, but they don't just magically appear. And so there's lots of meetings, there's lots of training that goes on to get them to the spot where they're actually out there handing you water or telling you to turn this way.
And where do those groups usually come from? Is it just organizations or?
Different organizations, school groups, church groups, Boy Scout groups, clubs, different clubs, school clubs, even National Honor Society. We leave no stone unturned to try to find those volunteer groups. In Ironman, Florida, they've got 3 or 4 senior adult groups that come out to work registration.
That makes sense in that area of the country. Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
there's some neat stories there of folks that have been doing it almost from the, or maybe even from the beginning. They're 21 years in now, and there are people who've been there every year checking in athletes at Ironman Florida. There's I want to say I recall from a athlete dinner before banquet dinner, them talking about some of those volunteers they've had just for years and years and years.
Yeah,
and it's the lifeblood of
their key coordinator there, and her name's Muggsy.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ben Rouse talked about Muggsy quite a bit down there. Yeah, so you're recruiting all over, trying to find those folks and try to get them a fit for the number of folks they have, their time frame for what they can volunteer for, and the spot. You not get a senior adult group out handing up water bottles on the bike course, but they've got their spot and registration, which you need, because a lot of times you can't get school groups to get out there on a Thursday or Friday during the day. They're in class and everything, so it's just matching it up with those groups. You've got those key areas that people like to do, the wetsuit stripping and the finish line catchers and all that kind of stuff. So I digressed a little bit there, but in terms of, as my role as a race director, that's a huge area for me of finding the volunteers and working with the volunteer director to make sure that happens and to help her do her job.
So the race finishes, it's over. What's kind of the pack up procedure? Is there a lot involved in the post race in terms of what you do?
There is, again, not necessarily me, but the staff, depending on where you are and how quickly you have to vacate the premises. In Ironman, Texas, we have to get off of that street by the next morning. So we're having to move the portos, the finish line, you know, the structures, the soft fencing, the barricades, the trash, all of that stuff by, you know, 6 a.m. the next morning to get things ready there. And the courses are the same. Your crew's out there picking up tape arrows and signs and markers and all that stuff. So buoys out in the water, doing all that, you know, course wrapping up through the day there. But then the nighttime stuff, you've got the nighttime crew that are out there cleaning stuff up. I'm fortunate to be able to head toward the rack at about 2 a.m. on a full Ironman, and then be able to get up at 7 and start going again the next day. But they work in shifts, and so a lot of them will, if they're doing the overnight shift, they'll have taken a 6-hour break the day before. But, you know, typically for me, it's, 2 a.m. to 2 a.m. on race day for a full.
So from all everything we just talked about, everything that you have to oversee and everything that has to come together for a race to happen and to succeed, you know, what's maybe the most difficult part of a race coming together? Is it the course? Is it getting the approvals from the local government? Like, what's usually the most difficult part of putting on a race?
Could be a combination of that. It's definitely the local agencies and getting everybody on board and staying on board from year to year for that, as agency leads and coordinators can change from year to year, is to make sure that happens. And then I think, again, the coursework can just depend on whether you're having to change all of that. We've had some interesting things in Ironman, Texas with our different courses. And that has been very challenging with our bike course over the years.
Yeah.
And It's behind the scenes stuff that athletes don't get to see much of, and at times have some frustrations related to that, especially not getting maps in advance as much as they would want to, when we very much would love to have those maps and to them 6 to 9 months mm-hmm. in advance if we could.
So we need to know it's never the race director that is withholding the maps from us athletes.
That's correct. Now I could blame it on Ironman Central at times, but it's typically folks outside of our control.
I'm sure.
When that's happening, to get that final approval from that city official or that county official or even sometimes a state official to make it happen. With Ironman Texas, crazy race, and we'll talk about that probably in a little while in terms of what are the crazy times you've experienced, but having to deal with Union Pacific Railroad and having to pull in a United States congressman to help get the approval for that.
Wow.
Like, we never stop our trains. We never stop them. Mm-hmm. Like, well, we really need you to.
Please just once.
And so we had to pull in the heavy hitter, and we're able to get it done. Now we had to pay their union flaggers to come out, you know, to work the race for those spots. But it happened.
Wow.
So, yep. So I'd say those are some of the key things.
So once all those preparations are in place, you know, I'm sure you're keeping an eye on the weather heading up to race day. I mean, just as much, if not more so, than we, the athletes, are. Once the big day finally arrives, you know, what does race day itself look like for you?
Typically, it's a 2 to 3 a.m. wake-up call. Is this when I'm the race director? If I'm a course.
That's earlier than we wake up usually for races as athletes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because our bike course, a lot of times they start rolling out about 2 a.m. to go set the bike course, you know, and to get ready for a 6 a.m. start at some races there. And usually the command center opens up about 4 a.m. with our radios. But before then, you're just double checking on stuff, making sure all your folks are starting to arrive. Again, with Ironman, you've got quality professional folks that are doing that. So you're not having to go do a wake-up call for them because they haven't shown up at a particular spot. They're where they're supposed to be when they need to be there and are already started working. I talked about earlier, you are like a conductor of an orchestra. And so you're just kind of fine-tuning things throughout the day. And you're working with this group right here, you know, the flutes right here, and then you get the trombones. And then you hit the bass in the back, you know, for the start pistol thing get going. So you're just really just working with all those different folks. You're working with the police coordinator on that to be ready for an on-time start. You've got to know that all the police are out there. So you're talking to him throughout the early morning to make sure that your water safety folks as well. Do you have the boats? You have the resources, the kayaks, the lifeguards, the dive boat, all those things in place, again, for an on-time start. Your volunteers in transition to be able to body mark and get everybody to their places to go. So typically it's just you're bouncing. You're multitasking.
You sound a walkie-talkie all day long.
Yes. Yeah. And then your cell phone and the walkie-talkie.
Okay.
Both. Yes. Constantly. Yeah. You're multitasking all over the place and trying to appear calm when inside you might not be feeling that. About that, when folks are asking the athlete, yeah, is it going to happen? Oh, yeah, it's happening. And you're listening to the radio and your bike guy's out there saying, we're missing cones out there.
There's no way this is happening.
Yes. And it always does. You know, can you get the weather issues at times? So that could be another question.
So with all the multitude of races by now that you've overseen, you know, I'm sure you've seen it all. You know, what are some of the more unusual occurrences you've encountered in your time as a race director?
I think where there have been events where there have been some curveballs or surprises, where I've worked races where some homework didn't get done and there's trains that are crossing over. And so you're having to stop athletes and try to create time elements to be able to then deduct that time off their race time at the end of the race. that's definitely one. I think storms, of course, are always interesting ones to deal.
Which you've dealt with in Galveston aplenty.
Galveston there. Ironman Texas was probably we call it the crazy year.
That's the one that immediately came to mind. I thought that was going to be your immediate answer. Yeah, the storm at Ironman Texas.
Yes, and the crazy year, that was also when we had issues with the bike course and trying to get the 112 miles. And then we thought we had it using the Spring Creek Trail for that. And then the flood hit, and then we lost the 15 miles. And so then it
became, just days before the race, a section of road was washed out, right?
Correct. So yeah. Flood. It's still underwater on race week there, and having to do a 97 mile bike ride that had 95 turns some of our staff were flying in for the race saying, somebody's going to die. Just with so many turns.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And then you add in that storm that happened. And again, you're trying to recreate times for everybody with that and to get the race restarted was...
So the storm was a hell of a storm. It was a front that came in. It's actually a pretty typical. I believe it was still in May back then.
Yeah, spring storm.
The day it heated up as it does in Texas in the spring, and this storm came largely out of nowhere. So it went from a hot afternoon, all of a sudden the sky turns black, and it starts to rain. It starts to thunder. The Ironman Texas is in a kind of semi-urban area with a bunch of parking garages. And I just remember the thunder being so loud and so close, the buildings were shaking and all the car alarms were being set off because the thunder was so intense. And then the hail started, and there's still athletes out there on the course. I mean, it's the driving rain, you can hardly see the athletes out there.
So this isn't just race day. This is in the middle of the race.
Middle of the marathon. Okay. I'm bunkered down in a parking garage with all the car alarms going off, trying to just see through. And the rain is coming down sideways in quintessential Texas weather fashion. Then the hail starts. And then finally, that Ironman Texas is a three-loop course. It's somewhere around 8.5 miles per loop. So there's athletes spread out over 8.5 miles and communicate somehow that the race needs to be paused because now there's frozen ice falling from the sky in pretty good size. You know, there were like some legit golf ball size hail falling. So, you know, you can't just leave people out there to run when like Armageddon is approaching.
So
that's kind of what Greg was referring to as the storm. But and then the race was paused, and then kind of again in true Texas weather fashion, it just moved on and turned into a lovely spring afternoon. So then the race had to be restarted.
Wherever those athletes were.
Yeah, which right, obviously get a little bit of a logistical course. Challenge to kind of get
figure
everything
out.
Going again.
Yes, the timing people earned their living
that
day trying to help recreate some times. And from what I've been told, they were really good at getting, you know, those times back for those folks because they were stopping people at aid stations and holding them there. You had athletes, some I'm not stopping, you know, keep running, you know, with that. And again, parking garages, like you said, restaurants, you name it. You're getting out of the weather or trying to stop them and do all that. So that's probably the race that I would, you know, that comes to mind for craziness.
And then one too much a couple years later, the big storm in Galveston that shut down everything.
Yes, on the run
was, as well. Another one that was.
We had probably 50 to 70 still on the bike course trying to get them in.
John Mayfield was still on the run course.
I was on the run course, and I had the thought that, oh my gosh, there's people out on the bike course because the wind kicked up, and it was, I have no idea how strong the wind is. But it was at least like 100 miles an hour. No exaggeration.
At least, yeah.
Not at all.
Of course.
Not at all exaggerating. It was at least 100 miles an hour. Greg will confirm that.
So Greg, that happens, that the weather rolls in both of those scenarios. I mean, as a race director, are you just doing the best you can in the moment to navigate that? Or do you guys have kind of like some plans in place, some what-if scenarios in place on what to do if stuff like that happens?
We do. We have those what-if plans. Our weather contingency plans for if the swim has issues, we've got a 30-minute delay, 45-minute delay at a certain point, you can't delay it anymore and still keep the timelines and still work with the city folks and the police and all that to make that happen. So then it rolls to a no swim and then a time trial bike start, all those kinds of things. And then the weather stuff, part of our emergency action plan has to deal with where are those shelters that you have for the swim, bike, and run. You know, where are you directing your people to go to for that as well. So that's what we're doing. One of our main key guys that was in Galveston, he basically caught the clock that was starting to fall down there.
Yep.
I think kept from hitting some people there. So they still talk about that one as well. But yeah, we've got the weather contingencies in place. We've got the, you know, the what we call the crazy contingencies in place, just because of crazy stuff that happens out in the world these days, as we know, with whether it's, you know, shootings or bombs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We're putting all of our emergency action plans in place. We have to have that in place to be able to work with the city on that, because you're having those agency meetings with those folks, and they're asking you, okay, what if this happens? What if that happens? And so you have had to do your homework in order to go over with them, you know, and they've got all their people, you know, in place that, of course, the athlete doesn't see,
right?
Whether it's, you know, bomb dogs or, you know, all those things that are going out there that nobody really sees.
Because it's great for us to know that exists. I mean, we all know what happened in the Boston Marathon. So, I mean, we are subject to that. We're not immune to that, but it's great to know that those procedures are in place and that is being taken care of and watched out for.
Sure. Yeah. The water barricades that are out there, fire trucks that they'll place in front of streets so that somebody can't come through with a truck. Some of our budget trucks, police, they'll borrow those if we've got two or three extras to help blockade some stuff. And again, they've gone through all their training as well for those type of events. And so
we think it's just a truck parked on the side of the road, but in reality, it's serving a strategic purpose.
Right. Yes. It's like it's in the way almost for an athlete, but there's a gap there you to run through, but it also means that a car can't get through there as well. So those extra things.
So athletes, when you're out there and you see those trucks, just give them a quick little salute and keep on running. So Greg, many athletes in our audience, you know, pretty much all of the athletes in our audience, probably, you know, were affected at some point by race postponements and cancellations due to COVID-19. It was a tough year, you know, for the sport all around. And I'm sure race organizers and race directors were just as gutted by the lack of racing as we were as athletes. Just talk briefly about what it was like navigating the pandemic as a race director.
Beyond frustration would be the key word there. Trying to figure out how you're supposed to make it happen within the COVID protocols and all of that, getting the stuff from USAT. And then Ironman had their global team working on, you know, documents that we were going to be utilizing for that, and having to learn all those things and then implementing those with tape spots on the ground and extra barricades, and going from 8 and 10 bikes to a rack to 4 and 5 bikes to a rack, and expanding your zone, you know, even more, all those different things. Very frustrating seeing that, doing the work for the event and then for it then to be canceled and postponed.
So you felt that.
Yeah. I did. I basically produced 5 races last year because of Ironman Texas not happening in the spring, and then moving to Waco and not happening there, for Galveston not happening in the spring and then not happening in the fall, and then Waco not happening. I basically, in a sense, other than race week, produced 5 events and none of them happened.
Yeah. Jeez.
And
so a whole lot of work with nothing to show for it, both from the athletes and you as the race director had the same thing.
Yeah. So you're frustrated. You've done all that work and then you end up spending all the time canceling all the orders and all the things that you had spent all that time before. And of course you don't get any extra pay for that as well. So you just get to grin and bear it. And so I understand as the athlete frustrated, and at times I think there was, not on purpose, lack of communication that happened over the course of the year. And again, there's behind the scenes stuff that's happening that a lot of people don't see, whether you're trying to get a new permit, you know, together for something, or dealing with the authorities at whatever state or location that you're in. Mm-hmm. Are they going to give you permission, you know, to have the race, you know, during COVID? And that, you know, in Waco, we thought we had it and we were planning for that. And then 3 weeks before, you know, the mayor just says, I'm leaving here in 2 months. And if something goes bad, I don't want that to be the last thing on my watch.
Wow.
And so not going to be able to have it. So again, it just frustrated, beyond measure, for that,
as a race director.
So Greg, none of your Ironman events happened this past year during COVID, but you did have Oilman, what was successful to happen, right? Because that's normally a fall race.
Yes, it is a fall race. I forgot about that. We were able to get that in.
Great.
In early November this past year when everything else was going through the cracks.
Yeah.
There. So it was exciting to do. Montgomery County is an awesome place to have races, and they were kind of wide open last fall, and they said, yeah, come on in, do it. The resort was open to it, and we followed the protocols, the COVID protocols, the masks, everything going on up there. Less bikes on the rack. We went 6 instead of 8. And we had about 450 people. It was down from our normal numbers, but it was really excited to get in a race. I was a little worried about my volunteer groups, again, okay, with the COVID happening. And within a day, all my volunteer groups signed up.
Wow.
To work. They were ready to get back to.
So they were ready to get back to racing.
To volunteering, yes, yeah,
that's super cool.
And raising money for, you know, their charities and all of that. So that was really excited. And then you're, you know, hoping to build it, and the people come in terms of the racers. And again, there were definitely, you know, quite a few folks that were wanting to get out there and race. And again, for us, our thing is we think big and race local in terms of how we do Oilman. So we feel like it's put on, you know, in a really big way out there at the resort. So, yep, come this next November, come on to Oilman.
So Greg, races are back at this point, you know, in the year that we're recording this. You know, we all three of us have been to multiple races this year. You've already put on one stellar event in Galveston this year, and it's been so good seeing athletes back on course. I mean, I just standing 0.2 miles from the finish line at Ironman Tulsa, just a little bit back, watching athletes, you know, that close to the finish line running down, running through downtown Tulsa, it was just electrifying, right? So racing's back. It's better than ever. We're all pumped about it. As a race director, you know, what emotions go through you as you watch athletes out on course, back at it, finishing races and fulfilling their dreams?
Well, you're excited for them. Again, you're excited for, again, your fellow race director that's in Tulsa or whatever, that they've gotten to get to the completion, to the finish line, in the sense for them, because they have their own finish line as a race director of completing that themselves. And so there's excitement about that, because you've sweated and bled with them at other races. And we talk on the phone at least twice a month with groups about that, and going through our protocols and, you know, what's the best thing, and, you know, give me some tips on this, and how can we make this happen given the COVID protocols. You know, you got a lot more room in Galveston for your transition, and Haines City, we got this tiny little spot to work. So how do you make it work? So we've been, you know, living it and breathing it with them along the way. So you're excited for them. You know, you're like excited for, okay, I'm going to be able to have a couple of events in October, and being excited for that. You're excited that maybe you won't have to go through all the COVID protocols that you've built up for and be able to do racing as usual, in a sense. And I think we're working our way toward that. You know, there's some little bits there. The last two events I was with the last 2 weeks, a lot of that stuff has been rolled back in a sense, the tape arrows on the ground like they were previously. They're putting a few more people in transition, you know, than they had with the bike racks. You're not having to wear the mask to Expo or those different places like we did in Galveston, per se. So that's all great to see, and hope that it continues. I think they're still dealing with some stuff up for Placid. I think you're going to have a a vaccine passport or something to do that race. So there's a few out there, I think, that have some elements involved. But from what I've been told is we're looking toward the fall. I think it's going to be wide open in the good sense of being able to bring back the wetsuit strippers and the bike handlers and all those things that we're so accustomed to with the foals and other parts of that, sunscreen teams and et cetera on that. So that's the direction that I've been given these last 2 weeks from some of the higher ups. So really excited about what we call business as usual, or for the athletes, pleasure as usual.
So Greg, my final question for the day, what would I have to do to get you to give me bib number 1 at Ironman Waco this year?
Send me an email,
say a prayer, and
become the top ranked professional male in the field.
I can see what I can do.
Is there a pro field?
I don't know yet, actually. I believe there is for both of those races, but I'm not sure if it's – sometimes it's a male only, a female only. I'm not sure yet for that. So there's been – have been special circumstances where folks have gotten special bib numbers before.
I do not merit a special bib number. Okay. I'm mostly joking. Yeah. just so you don't walk away from this thinking like, oh, man, really?
Yes. It has happened, but it's pretty much – a very special occasion.
As the self-proclaimed captain of the middle pack, he needs like 500 or something like that.
That's more accurate. Yeah, yes. That's much better. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I'm excited to come race your event for sure.
What I could probably do is have a say with the race official about that penalty that you might get out there drafting and see if I could get it lessened.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is good. This got me somewhere, John.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
For our cool down today, while we have Greg with us, I thought we could end the show by getting just kind of a few of his race recommendations. So, Greg, you travel all around the country working for Ironman events, and as a five-time Ironman finisher yourself, I mean, you know a thing or two or three about what makes a great race course. So for all the athletes in the audience who are maybe scouting out their next event, maybe we have some folks already planning their next race season, if it were you, with all the venues you've been to over the years, what events would you be looking to sign up for if you were racing again next year?
Sure. Besides the three venues that I race direct for, of course, I would
recommend
those.
Because obviously, those are standout events. Yes.
Yes. Well done. Races for sure. Probably Lake Placid would be definitely. I would love to go and compete at that place right there.
Even just, with the crazy climbs and the mountains, yes, and the hills?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, just the scenery is spectacular. The swim in Mirror Lake is unbelievable there as well. I did Louisville way back the first year of that one. Again, it's gone now. But that bike course, I mean, was definitely challenging in parts, but so scenic out there with the horse farms and all of that. I have a partiality to Ironman Florida just because it's similar terrain to here. And so those were all my best races successfully completed time-wise there. So like that place, again, Gulf Coast is always a great spot. Trying to think stuff that I would like to do. Probably Ironman. I wanted to do Santa Rosa, just okay, with the wine country. I worked that one several times, so I got to stay a couple extra days and go to some of the wineries and everything. So I would have loved to have done that race, yeah, even though it was point to point with that. Just the bike race is amazing. And then that swim up at the reservoir was cool. So I don't know what the Sacramento race is like just yet.
We'll all find out.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll all see. So we have Coach Jeff Raines from the TriDot group is doing that one as well as many other TriDot athletes. So I'm sure we'll hear tales about the inaugural Sacramento later this year. So
yes.
Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank race director Greg Pennington for taking us behind the scenes of putting on a multi-sport race. Thanks, of course, to John Mayfield for joining the conversation as well. And a big thanks to TriBike Transport for partnering with us on today's episode. Head to tribiketransport.com and use coupon code TRIDOT25 to set up your bike transport for your next race. Enjoying the show? We'd love for you to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts to help our show find its way to new listeners. We'll do it all again soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot Podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.